Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals the hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I'm just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening and happy Shabbat, Kirk. I have a tough question for you. How many invitations are there to meet with Yahweh each year?
There are seven.
Can you name them?
Sure. There's Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, then we have Shavuot, Teruah, Yom Kippurim, and Sukkah.
That's what I thought, too. That's the same number I have, and those are the same titles that I have. I assume that we have the same number and the same titles because those are the seven that are presented in the book of Shemot, then presented in detail in the book of Kara, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Is there any other presented
in the Torah? No, sir, not one.
Oh, okay, all right. You know that today is Happy Purim.
Okay.
Jews don't like to celebrate things like, for example, Shavuot, because you know Shavuot was confiscated and turned into Pentecost, so they just hate Shavuot. And they don't really like Bikurim. I don't think there's any mention of Bikurim. You know, they celebrate Passover, but they really don't talk about Passover in conjunction with unyeasted bread. Other than they'll do the unyeasted bread thing, but they don't understand that the entire 3 days is really unyeasted bread, with the doorway to it being Pesach, and the result of it being Bikurim. But when it comes to Shavuot, it's not on the rabbinical calendar. Don't even find it there anymore. What you find is kind of an odd-placed event, and it has to be at the end of the year, because we really haven't reached the beginning of the year. So it had to be at the end of the year. So I mean, I'm assuming that since they already had Hanukkah, the rabbis were looking for their own Halloween. But I'm going to tell you now, I happen to know enough about Purim to be dangerous. So I'm going to read an article. This is published in Haaretz. And Haaretz is Haaretz, it's the land. It's probably the number one news source in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And they wrote an article called "What Is Purim? The History Behind the Halloween of Jewish Holidays." Yeah, I was just kidding about Halloween. They even have it in the title. What's its origin? When did it begin? Why did so many Jews initially scorn it? And why? And what is the underlying tale of love, murder, and betrayal? By the way, is there any stories of murder or betrayal among the seven of Yahweh's Moed Mikre?
Well, I guess the Romans certainly killed Yosha, but I mean, was
killed by Passover lamb, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right. Purim is the most mysterious of Hebraic holidays. It suddenly appeared in the 2nd century BCE. And I ask you, Kirk, when was the last prophet? Approximate dates of the last prophet?
Well, if you're counting from the Torah,
Malachi.
Malachi,
huh? About 450-500 BCE?
Yeah, that's about it. That's where I
came. Okay. So this came into being in the 2nd century BCE, so you got a problem there, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Was there any revelation during that time?
No, sir.
So many Jews ignored it for centuries, and the origin of the holiday, let alone its flagship text, is the Book of Esther, which it writes is just as baffling. Of the books that are presumed possibly to be inspired by Yahweh, that are part of the Dead Sea Scrolls collection of the Essenes, do you know which book is missing?
It wouldn't surprise me if it's Esther. I don't recall it being.
That's the answer. Esther is the answer. Esther is the only one that is missing. No Esther. You know how many prophecies there are in Esther?
No, I don't. Are there any?
Zero. Do you know how many times, and I've been doing this now for 20 years, and I'd often work on this 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. I've translated a fair amount of the Torah prophets and Psalms. Do you know how many times I found it appropriate to translate a citation from the Book of Esther?
I'm sure as zero. I've read most everything you've written, so.
Yeah, it's about as often as the Song of Songs, you know, which is a love story, I think, to Astarte, and a number of times that I've translated the Book of Ecclesiastes.
Mm-hmm.
The answer would be zero. I wouldn't make it, you know, this out of the other, but, you know, I'm fascinated by Yahweh's teaching, fascinated by his prophetic utterances. I know everything I can about the covenant, and I've never had a reason to look at Esther. She might have been a nice lady. Evidently, if the story's true, she was really pretty. You know, her claim to fame was the king of Persia was holding a contest because he wanted to marry the prettiest woman, and she won the contest. Yeah, something like that, right? So that's basically the story. And as I understand it, Mordecai encouraged her to go before the king and tell the king, "Hey, you know, it's just not cool that you've got underlings who are wiping out the my people. You know, I happen to be Jewish, and you've got them wiping out my people. I appreciate if you doesn't do that." And that evidently was the impetus for celebrating this as a holiday. The first reference to Purim is in the Book of Maccabees. Do you have Maccabees in your Torah prophets and Psalms?
I haven't on my shelf, but not my Torah prophet and Psalms, no.
No, it's apocryphal. The Book of Maccabees, you know, talks about how of Israelites tried to stave off the Greek control of the religious core of Israel, and they loved Greek ideas. You know, the Greek sophists, the Greek Gnosticism, the Greek yarmulke, you know, sun god worship, all that. They absorbed all that. They just didn't want the Greeks interfering in their little religious groups because that was their power. And so Maccabees is sort of the religious revolt against Greek influence. And by the way, the Greeks didn't really give a hoot about Israel. You know, at the time of the Greeks, Israel was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a place to walk through between Persia, which Alexander had conquered, and Egypt, where Alexander was worshipped as a god.
Right.
So it was just a backwater place at the time. But so it's the first time it's mentioned is in Maccabees. As mentioned in Maccabees 2:15-32, which merely says that on the 14th of the Jewish month of Adar, Jews celebrated a holiday called Mordecai Day. Clearly, the holiday was celebrated in at least some Jewish communities as early as 124 BCE, when this book was written in Alexandria. So you know automatically that you've got a problem with Maccabees. It was written about the same time that the Book of Enoch was written. So, 2nd century BCE. It was also written in Alexandria, of all places. The Jewish historian Josephus, you know, the traitor, the Jew turned Roman, kind of like the Jewish Paul. Well, Paul was also Jewish. Running in the 1st century CE, mentions the holiday, noting that it was widely celebrated. Yet it seems the holiday failed to gain acceptance by all Jews until the early Middle Ages. For example, Esther is the only megalon not found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, indicating that the desert community didn't consider it canonical. Yet the Mishnah, I think was mostly compiled, by rabbinical Jews, tells us that at least from the time of Bar Kokhba revolt, you know, if you're banking something on the Bar Kokhba revolt, you know you're in trouble. That's when Rabbi Akiva made the decision that that it was another Yobel year, and they had and they knew the timing that the Mashiach was supposed to arrive. And when they decided that they didn't much like the like Yosha, then he decided that Bar Kokhba would be his Messiah. And that, so Bar Kokhba is Akiva's Messiah. And he was a warlord, and it turned out to be disastrous. The uprising that Rabbi Akiva masterminded under Bar Kokhba is what got Israel, the land-salted Jews, hauled off to slavery throughout Europe by the Romans. Thousands crucified and a place renamed Philistia. Worked out really well. So the father of rabbinic Judaism is the man most responsible for their 1900-year exodus from the land.
Exactly.
And that's the time that it was really in vogue. That's a bad sign. So, and you're supposed to read from the Book of Esther on Purim, and it was considered a mitzvah, which would be a religious law by the rabbis. The Talmud itself refers to some who doubted whether the Purim should be celebrated as a Jewish holiday still. Clearly, by the time of the Mishnah and Talmud, Purim was celebrated. Many translations and exegesis of the Book of Esther can be found in this period more on this period than any other book. Isn't that really interesting? So rather than studying the Torah, rather than studying Dodes Mizmor, rather than studying the book of Yeshayah or Yirmiyah, the rabbis during this time spent all their focus on the book of Esther, which, you know, in all likelihood doesn't have any divine inspiration.
No hope at all.
The holiday's origin is heatedly disputed. A number of pagan holidays, Greek, Persian, Assyrian, and Babylonian, have been suggested as candidates, but none really suits perfectly. No, this is a rabbinic holiday. The story in the Book of Esther appears in the in Hebrew as follows. There was Assyrius was the king of Persia. He wants his wife, Vashti, to show off her beauty before his guests. She refuses. So Assyrius's servants hold an ancient version of the bachelor, bringing the most beautiful woman of the kingdom. One is Esther, a hero of the book, and an orphan raised by her uncle Mordecai. After his niece becomes queen, because she won the beauty contest, so congratulations, that makes her really special. Mordecai discovers a palace. Doesn't he always say, don't hometown of Kensington, she marries one.
Mm-hmm. Over and over.
Yep. Mordecai discovers a palace plot to assassinate Asterius. And he tells the king, who has the plotters killed. At about this point, period, one of the king's viziers, Haman, rises to supremacy. Everyone, including the other viziers, must bow before him. Mordecai refuses. Furious, Haman, somewhat overreacts, deciding not only to have Mordecai killed, but to have all of the kingdom's Jews killed as well. Now, does it seem plausible to you, Kirk, that a king who has just assassinated people who he was told wanted him dead is going to allow one of his viziers to have people bow down before him? Wouldn't a guy who would suppress a just a rumor of a coup, killing everyone whom it was even suggested might be involved in a coup, you think that that kind of a guy is going to have one of his viziers have everyone that comes before him bow as if he were king?
Well, I wouldn't think so.
What do you think that the chances are that Haman would then have the power to kill every Jew in the kingdom because one Jew wouldn't bow down to him? Have you ever seen a kingdom, any ancient kingdom, particularly one as powerful as Persia, where somebody that far down the chain of command would have life and death authority over an entire ethnicity of people?
Hardly. Hardly.
No.
Just me. No. It's not going to happen.
No. By the way, I just was curious. Do you know how many times Yahweh's name is mentioned in the book of Esther?
I'm willing to bet none.
That would be the answer. So what do you think the likelihood is that a book that does not mention Yahweh's name was inspired by Yahweh?
Yeah, I like his name.
Yeah.
For many, many reasons.
Yeah. By the way, Purim is obviously the plural of poor. Poor means to cast lots or roll dice.
Hardly Yahweh's style.
Yeah. So, hearing of this, Mordecai. Now, Mordecai, of course, was the one that went to the king the previous time and said, "Oh boy, it is a plot to kill you." Mordecai urges Esther. This time he is afraid to go to the king. He was going to the king when the king alone was evidently the victim of a plot. But now you got an entire ethnicity, and Mordecai is scared out of his britches. And he urges the beauty queen, Esther, to talk to the king and have him rescind the execution orders sent through the out throughout the kingdom. Although, by the way, you know how many, the Persians and the Babylonians were great, and the Assyrians, about recording everything that was significant in their kingdom?
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall ever seeing this, do you?
No.
Although approaching the king uninvited was perilous, Esther fasts for 3 days and does it. Oh my God, she does it. She's a heroine. She's got the courage to go in front of her husband, inviting him and Haman to a banquet. At the banquet, the king asks Esther what she wanted, and she wants only one thing, and that is he and Haman to come to another banquet the next day. That night, the king can't sleep. Presumably, to help him relax, he asks his servants to read to him from the kingdom's chronicles. I mean, this story is so convoluted. There's no reason. You've got to be a moron to believe it. As it happened, the servants read how Mordecai saved them from certain death. And he asked how Mordecai was rewarded, and he was told he wasn't. Ah, yeah, right. next morning, I'm on rushes to, into the king's chamber to ask for permission to execute his evil plot. But they, now, mind you, the story just says that the orders were already sent through the, out the kingdom. So now he's coming in and saying, oh, by the way, can I have authority to do this? But the king preempts him. What shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? Haman, thinking the king was talking about him, told him that such a man should be paraded in the streets of the capital on a horse in splendor, with a man walking in front announcing that this is what happened when kings, who the king delighteth to honor. That she was frustrated. The king ordered that to be done to Mordecai, not to him, but he was, carried out the command. That night, he went to Esther's banquet, and Esther told Asherius about Haman's plot, and the king stormed out in anger. Later, Haman went to Esther's room to beg for mercy. But as he lay prostrate on her bed, this is the man that now made everybody bow down to him, and he's bowing down to a woman on her bed begging. The king walked in and mistook what he had seen as an attempt by Haman to rape his wife. He ordered Haman hanged, and ordered the Jews throughout the kingdom to protect themselves from those who would come to kill them, as the orders could not be rescinded anymore. I want to tell you, this is the dumbest story I think I've ever read. On the 13th of Adar, on the next day, the Jews around the kingdom killed thousands of their attackers, but they themselves were saved. So you've got a minority here that isn't Persian, killing Persians that are armed to the teeth.
Yes.
And having none of the, and having the king say, I don't really give a crap if my police, my army are killed by these Jews. Ah, it doesn't mean anything to me because, you know, what the heck. Oh, the historicity of this story is highly contested, so it says in Haaretz. If you think, proponents note, the great detail in dates, names, and objects mentioned, even to the seemingly unimportant aspect of the story. They argue that the description of court life fits what we know about Persian court from other sources, but it's still stupidly unlikely. No other ancient texts tell anything like this story, nor does a serious character fit any of the known Persian monarchs.
No.
And the most convincing argument against the story's veracity is that a Persian king would never have married an orphan of unknown parentage. The Mishnah is the first text to prescribe how Purim is to be celebrated. The book of Esther is to be read in public. The Talmud arguments in the tradition regarding the book of Esther in public when drinking wine, making merry, and giving gifts to the poor. That is prescribed in the book of Esther itself, but seems to be an addition to the book. Neither that practice nor the name Purim itself appear in the earlier version of the book of Esther, which we know from the Greek translation of Septuagint, dates to around the 2nd century BCE. Of special importance in the Talmud is drinking wine on Purim. Yeah, you better be stone intoxicated. I mean, drunk as a skunk. If this stupidity is going to fool anybody, we've said it a billion times. You have to be an utter imbecile to think that Christmas and Easter are godly.
Yes.
You do. You just have to be an absolute nincompoop. It's someone who hasn't even bothered to spend 5 minutes investigating the history of these things or wondering why the text of their religion doesn't even mention them.
That's a good point.
Now, they're purely Babylonian. And yet, you've got arguably the smartest people in the history of the world, Jews, who religiously, almost unanimously, celebrate.
Why
in the hell? And in the next, you know, the Teruah, they've just gone right to the Babylonian holiday of Rosh Hashanah.
Yes, I know.
What in the hell is wrong with them? And then on the Day of Reconciliations, they're so twisted, they make it the day of torture and denial,
mm-hmm.
of affliction.
Yes,
how is it that people who are this smart could be this unbelievably stupid? But, okay. I'm here to tell you, I've announced this in advance. I don't know enough about Purim to be dangerous. But we just read an article from the most credible news source in Israel, Haaretz.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you want to cry.
Yeah.
No wonder God is so
disgusted,
upset with all of us.
Yeah.
The most widely observed Purim traditions are dressing up and masquerading. That's why it's called the Jewish Halloween.
Yeah, makes sense.
Masquerading. They're masquerading as God's people. Oh, and drinking like
fish.
Like fish.
Mm-hmm. That's I knew nothing of that holiday. I'm amazed. Absolutely amazed.
I'm amazed. I'm discouraged. I'm amazed. I'm disappointed.
And
wow. Now let's go back to something that you found interesting. I read a paragraph introducing what I thought was a fairly insightful bit of analysis, and we were studying the dichotomy between Esau and Jacob.
Right.
And what Yahweh had to say about them, and how English translations make an absolute mockery of the testimony that's provided here. And we've just begun that. But in the introductory paragraph, this is what I wrote, and you decided that it might be interesting to study the names of these individuals. So as promised, it is time to uncover the stone that is Leom, the antiquated people of these nations who are congregating under a unifying religious or political leader. To see what lingers beneath its etymology. Leom only appears a score of times in the entirety of the Torah prophets and Psalms. The first three times are similarly revealing. We find them in the 25th chapter of Bereshit, Genesis, where the story reveals that Abraham had taken another wife, Keturah, who gave the father of the covenant six additional sons, none of whom inherited anything because Yitzhak remained his sole heir, as Yahweh had intended. Then Abraham died. The 12 descendants read the opposite of Israel, of Ishmael, affirmed as the son of Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's slave, are then subsequently delineated. After this brief interruption, the story of man continues with the account of the family line of Abraham's son, Yitzhak, and his marriage to Rebekah at 40 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
So you looked up the names that I just sort of passed over in this bit on the six names of Abraham's subsequent children. What did you learn?
Well, I number one, I was stunned at how evil the names are. First
really?
Of all, I mean every one of them are rather horrible. The thing that was most disturbing about it was that. If you go through, I looked up all of Esau's sons because you mentioned that they had 12, and I didn't know that. And I looked those up, and once again, it was extremely disturbing on what, and quite obvious of what Yah was trying to, I always look at this as Yah was trying to teach you something.
Yeah, every name is trying to teach something.
Yeah, he's not just throwing them out just to throw them out.
Right.
Now, the hard part about
it. Yeah, like, for example, Yishak. The direct, most common definition of Yishak is laughter,
mm-hmm.
but that's really not what lies at the core of the core of the word.
Mm-hmm.
It means child's play.
Yeah.
That's a playful child. a child who's fun to be around, a child who's having fun, enjoying himself. So Yitzchak literally describes the covenant both from child and father's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
A child playing, having fun.
So the covenant,
that's what we're going to do in eternity. That's why Yahweh created us. So,
yeah.
Pretty good work, huh?
Yeah.
So what do you find? Why don't you go through the names?
Okay, they're not totally in order, but this is the order that I looked them up in, and there's Medan.
Okay.
It's one of the children, and it means discord and strife. And it comes, now you have to go, a lot of these I had to go to the verbal root to figure out what it was in the first or second go through. And it comes from the verb Medan, which is strife. It means a contentious woman. It means a quarrelsome man. It's a brawler. It's one who spreads strife and discord. From the and that's also from den, the verb to judge, dispute, quarreling, to be obedient, submissive, and then I think Islam, Christianity too, of course, to plead a cause for men, as the Muslims claim their cause, to plead a cause of orphans, and I think my comment there was Palestinians or Fakistinians. I like the way Dr. Jeff calls them. To sail direct, sail, S-A-I-L. And I was thinking, well, wow, what does that relate to anything? Well, if you think about the context of what we're talking about in this era when they all sail across to the Magog War. So I'm looking at every little source. I'm not saying all these are the right connection, but it was amazing. I could not find hardly anything that was positive about Medan. Another name is Yakshun. From Yakwash is to lay a bait, a lure, a snare, a trapper, entanglement. It is figuratively for the devices of the wicked. It's used figuratively for the device of wicked, of the wicked people. It's used in Deuteronomy 7:25 in regards to engraved idols. They were to, and they cite where they were to destroy those idols and not covet the gold or the silver, and they weren't supposed to take it with them because to Yahweh this is detestable. So every time they. So, once again, the word everywhere you go is negative. Shuach is one of the other ones. Shuach is to bow down, to sink down. From Shua, which also means wealth. In Arabic, Shuach means to melt away, to flow away, and to vanish. The ultimate end, I said, of so many. Then you have Zimran. From Zimar, it means to praise in song, to make music. I thought more of the Christian praising songs and the CPL bug, and they're constantly singing praises of, which I'm not sure. I know that y'all is not into it for us for the praising, to be praising him all day. Zimar is to trim, also or to prune, used as or similar to Nazar. The only reason I focus on that a while is because Nazar is the base for Nazarite, and they are considered untrimmed vines, perhaps a metaphor for being separated. Now, there's a positive and negative side to that. You can obviously separate yourself from God, or you can separate yourself from man's ways. And then I found an interesting thing on that related way. They use the word in Ezekiel 14:7. He says, from when any Israelite or foreigner abiding in Israel separates himself, using the word Nazar, from me, sets up idols in his heart and puts a wicked stumbling block before his face, and then came to the prophet to inquire about me, I, Yahweh, will answer him. I'll set my face against that man and make him a sign, a mark or an omen or warning, and as a proverb or a word picture, something to teach from. So Yah's not real thrilled about everything that's connected with Zimran. Then Midian or Midyah, properly, is the tribe of the Midianites, and sometimes it's referred to the Arabians are there too, part of that.
And by the way, Teresa, these things all have meaning in Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
It's because this group of, of Abraham's sons all became Arabs.
Yes.
You know, it was pointed out to me by a friend the other day. You know the name of Muhammad's tribe in Mecca? You know, I made the claim that Muhammad is probably 75 to 85% likely Jewish.
Well, because of Yathrib.
I made the claim because 3/4 of the population of Yathrib, where he was born, a place, by the way, named Yathrib, as in Yah, were Jewish tribes. 3/4 of the population. That's 70%, 75% likelihood. His mother was a widower. A widow. Her husband had died, and yet she had the money to hire someone to go and raise her son. And the Arabs in Yathrib were dirt
poor
and no means whatsoever. They were desperate. So it not only was a 75% likelihood, but you put that bit into it, it goes one step further. Do you know the name of Muhammad's tribe and
I don't.
In Mecca?
No, sir.
Banu, son of Hashem. Hashem.
The name is in,
son of the name.
Hmm.
Which is what the rabbinical group in Yathrib would have called their god.
But they wouldn't say Yahweh. No, they never
said Yahweh. They said Hashem. They were the sons of Hashem. So there's a reason that all of these names have an Arabic derivation. Remember when I was trying to translate the difference between Abram and Abraham?
Mm-hmm.
And I kept on saying, you know, this isn't all positive. This isn't all smiles. There's some really sinister stuff going on here. And that while Abram can mean merciful father, enriching and empowering father, uplifting father, it can also mean the father of those who are conniving and rebellious, who are hostile and vicious. And come to find out, Abraham, not only through Ishmael, which became Islam, but through these other six sons, fathered the Arabs that became the Muslims.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you trace them, we'll find everybody. I mean, and God, I don't know how somebody would come up with these names for their children, to be honest with you. You just wouldn't call your son something like to be a brawling, contentious
right.
Discord, but they did.
And it also strikes me, and I've said this before, and I get a lot of pushback on this, that there's a reason that everybody was chosen by God.
Mm-hmm.
There is a flaw there that God wants known in a particular context. So I've shared, you know, Moshe was chosen to present Yahweh's name and purpose to the world, to introduce Yahweh to the world, and he was a stutterer. So the very guy chosen to introduce Yahweh to the world had a speech impediment.
Mm-hmm.
The guy chosen to tell us how to benefit from the Torah broke every rule in the Torah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Yah's style, right? The guy that Yahweh used to reveal how to participate in the covenant was not a very smart dude.
No.
And it's basically saying, I'm going to make this really simple for you. I'm dad, you're kid. You want to participate in the family relationship, these are our dad's rules. And these are the things that dad's going to do for you. I'm going to make it so simple, Abraham will be able to understand. Because Abraham wasn't the smartest dude who ever lived.
No, apparently not.
But when you look at these names,
bad choices.
Would a smart man name his kids any of these names?
No, I mean, there's another one. I mean, there's a sixth one, but no, not at all.
Go ahead.
Not at all.
What's the other one?
Well, the Yitzchak.
Yitzchak.
It comes from Shobig, which means to leave, or Shibig,
right.
Which is to leave or let alone, or one that is left.
Right. Right.
It's
to be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
It's to be estranged.
Right. Five, so
why would you name a son estranged?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly a guy who has been told that he is the father of the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can tell you why he might name his son estranged, which is he knew that Yitzchak was the only heir to the covenant.
Yeah.
And therefore, Yitzchak was going to be estranged.
Yes. You know that story in Daniel, because when you're looking for, you find this word, Shebek, in this passage in Daniel. And I had never thought of this, but this is one of the joys that you get from doing what we do, at least for me. I find these little things. And now I'm looking up lots of the places where they use the words. And in Daniel 2, 43 and 44, this is, it came up with, it talks about, it's an end time prophecy. And let me read it to you, and then I'll tell you my little take on it, because for years I've known the prophecy about the Roman beast at end times, when you have the clay feet and the iron mixed together. And I just thought that meant a lot of different people. But now, to your point of Esau being Rome and a mixture of Islam, in Daniel, in this one it says, as you saw the iron mixed with the clay, so these people will be mixed together, but will not hold together any more than iron and clay. In the days of the kings, of Samiyin, of heaven, will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, and this kingdom will not be left, that's the Shabbat word, to another people. It will shatter all of these kingdoms. They will shatter all of these kingdoms. And they will bring them to an end, but it will stand forever, which is one of my favorite words along. He's basically said, unless I'm really missing the boat here, he's saying these combination of Roman and Islam will attack them. They will lose. And the kingdom he's going to set up, obviously it's going to be, because he's only going to set up one, and that's those. But I'd never put the mixture together as being that symbolic of who they were.
Right.
And I thought, wow, that is really, really informative. So, but it's just these little connections that are just so much fun.
Yes.
You know?
So I know you also went through children of Ishmael.
Yeah, I was fussing with you a lot because I went through... I couldn't find 12, and I just didn't go far enough because I was also looking up there. Well, maybe he's counting those and some of the grandchildren, like Amalek. And no, they're just about as terrible as you want to see. But if you want to, we can cover those a little bit.
Yeah, so the grandkids even go into Amalek, right?
Yeah. Well, I won't go into the grandchildren. I'll do his children first. And we have Eliphaz, which is God is gold or refined gold. And I said, well, that's not too bad. But the root is a picture. So on this one, I kept digging and digging and digging. I'm saying, well, I think there's got to be more here than that. And when you look at the picture, when you do it from the pictograph, it becomes a mouth and a plow. And it talks about purifying a metal. And, of course, a mouth is a cutting edge. And the metal, which is done like a plow, but it's a metal thing that cuts, and it's in this case, it's a weapon. So when I look through the different lexicons, they call it a cutting edge of a weapon. And that is, and it also is, of course, L being power. So it's a powerful man with a weapon, which is basically what they're confronting when they come to fight Islam, or when they're being attacked by Islam. So that's a warrior. That's not something that God is.
Yeah, and he is the forefather of the Nabataeans. Mm-hmm. You know, the Nabataeans had their capital at Petra, which was one of the, and remained for centuries, one of the most religious places on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Petra was Sin, the chief god of Petra.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Lord reigns supreme.
Yes, I am a
yeah, Petra is about as bad as it gets, and the Nabataeans were exceedingly religious,
mm-hmm.
and he's the forefather of them. So that's not a good start.
No, that. Well, if I had time, I've used up all my time coming up to the show, just trying to dig this out, trying to find all the 12. But the next one is Reuel, or Ruel, which is a pasture for cows and sheep. And I said, well, that's not too bad. But then the figuratively is used as an idolater. And there, it's mentioned by Yashayah uses it in that sentence, and he calls it a idolater or idol maker or idol worshiper that feeds on ashes. Hosea says he feeds on the wind, which I thought was kind of interesting because he's going to blow them away with the wind. And the mouth of fools, according to a Proverbs, feeds on folly. It also means bad temper, a bad-tempered man. It means to break with. It means evil entreaty, and to wander and wait. And I thought, my God, that's not a good name to have.
No.
I think I would pass on that one. What other choice do you have, Dad? The chaff is means pressed down. I'm sorry, that's the grandson. Let me skip that. Jews, a yaus, is a verb, and the verb form of us means to come to help or dissemble self and to hasten. But it also means, can mean, a twisting and consuming thing. It can be make haste, quickly prepare. And I was thinking about that for the picture of Magog when they finally get the orders to it, that they can still save them from him. That would be the time. Shalom is another son. He's an Edomite, and it's from Alam, which is occult in nature, is the meaning of occult. And the verb form is to conceal, to be blind, to be a secret, for instance, hide.
Well, occult, it defines what occult is.
Yeah. It's, yes, indeed. And, someone pays no attention. If they disregard, as they disregard Yahweh and his Torah, they neglect it. It also means to melt. And I thought, well, that's funny. But not when they're all going to melt when Yahweh shows up. Yahweh shows up. Korah. And I think this is Korosh is the verbal root for that. And it means to make ball. And well, I'm going kind of ball, so that's, you know, I can relate to that. But still, I don't think it was this. It is to shave your head. It's named after the great grandson of a Levi, a Loi, who was a leader of the rebellion against Moshe and Aaron while they were in the wilderness. That's what my little research came up with. And he was punished and died by earthquakes and flames of fire. That's not a good person to be related to or named after. Now, Raw, would that be close to Quran?
Yeah.
You have the same. Yeah, it's certainly got the Kaf and the Rosh. Then we have, let me flip over here. I got too many grandsons here.
Yeah, let's do. We'll do one more, and then we'll turn to the Esau, because we want to drill down on that, because I think that is especially revealing.
Okay, and then we have, let's find a good one here. Well, Anah is one of the sons, and you could say Anah can be a respond.
Right.
But Anah can also be to bow down and be afflicted, mistreated, ravaged, oppressed, violated, treated harshly and violent. But if somebody wants to get down, wants to go and look these things up, you'll be amazed at how many horrible things that they're just.
Yeah, Anah is one of those words that has a dark and light side, the good side and the dark side.
Yeah.
To afflict is the dark side.
Yeah. So
horrible.
Yeah, it's interesting. Every one of those names tells you something, but it also points in the direction of affirming that Ishmael is the father of Islam and Abraham's other sons, including Ishmael, but plus the six he had from his second wife. Yeah, Keturah, were became Arabs and Muslims.
Yeah.
So let's turn to Bereshith, Genesis 25:22, because this is the story, I think, that presents the ultimate beast. You know, Yahweh goes through and Daniel and describes the migration of nations, and he calls them beasts. And he says, you know, the beast, the mother of all beasts, is Babylon. And Yahweh never wavers from that. Babel continues to be the mother of whores. And so it begins with Babel, and that Babel was conquered and assimilated into Persia.
Mm-hmm.
And then Persia was conquered by and assimilated into Greece. And he said that then Greece would be conquered by and assimilated into Imperial Rome.
Right.
And then he said, out of Imperial Rome shall become the worst of all beasts, and the beast that will tread upon the whole world. Well, there's only one entity that grew out of Imperial Rome that had any influence, much less worldwide influence. Only one. So this does not take a rocket scientist to recognize he's talking about the Roman Catholic Church.
Right.
So in this particular story, what we find is that the Imperial Rome and then the Roman Catholic Church became Israel's and Yahweh's greatest foes. The plague of death and the kingdom of death. So, here's the story. And I think this is the story properly translated as opposed to the way you'll find it in your King Iams. Eshak, laughter and child's play, made a request to Yahweh on behalf of his wife because she was infertile. Now, if Eshak's wife is infertile, and Eshak is going to be the heir of the covenant, and the covenant's going to be Yahweh's family, do you think that it's Yahweh's intent for Eshak's wife to remain infertile?
I guarantee it's not.
No. So, I don't ask a lot of Yahweh. Occasionally, you know, something bugs me and I'll ask, but then I realize, listen, Yahweh's going to do what he wants to do. If our desires are aligned with his, then we're going to get exactly what we want. If they're not aligned with his, you know, well, good luck. You're on your own devices, right?
Right.
So here, Eshak asked Yahweh for something that Yahweh was intent on doing. So guess what? Yahweh responded to the request on his behalf, and Rebecca, his wife, conceived. But then the children within her struggled together in an oppressive way. They were tough. They were troublesome, splitting apart, harassing one another, trying to crush each other. Now, you think God chose a term of two embryos being at war with one another, trying to crush each other, because he was trying to describe, you know, a little brotherly rivalry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see.
Now, he's going to tell this prophecy about these two kids, tell us this story. It's about something that's serious. So I want you to tell me, in all the history of Yah's people, who was the most brutal of all, the most troublesome, the one that split Israel apart, that harassed them like none other, that literally tried to crush them and wipe them out?
What was the descendants of Esau? I mean,
yeah. What empire was that?
From the Amalekites all the way to Islam. I mean, just same groups.
Well, there's a lot of people that have tried to do that. But if you were to take Israel, Israel's enemies and say, this one was the most vicious. It's Rome.
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I just know it. It's cut and dry, Rome.
Yeah.
And she asked, if this is so, what is the reason why this is happening to me? So she went to seek Yahweh. No, Yahweh doesn't share detail. This woman's question is irrelevant to us unless the answer, unless there's something in this troublesome splitting apart and harassing one another, trying to crush one another, that is prophetic and profound. Otherwise, do you think Yahweh is really concerned about a woman who was unable to conceive, has now conceived, and she knows she has twins, and they're bebopping each other on the noggin?
Mm-hmm. No, it wouldn't.
You don't bother to figure it out. Shame on you. That's why it's being told to us. And Yahweh said, he provided the answer concerning her. Two estranged political and religious entities. This is Goyim. You know, one of those two kids is Jacob.
It's assumed to be, yeah.
And Goyim is, the primary use of Goyim is to say that which is not Israel.
Right.
When one of the two kids was Israel.
Yes.
I mean, that's got to hit you right between the eyes. Two estranged political and religious entities are in your womb. And I first read that and said, no, can't be. But I'm going to hear, God says of Esau, I hated him. Oh, what institution does God hate most on planet Earth? Roman Catholic Church. Of Esau, I hated him. The only person that God calls out by name to say I hated. And the other one is Jacob. He's a good dude, man. Jacob became Israel. How could he say that there are two Goyim in the womb?
Because that's when they were. I'm still Goyim.
Well, the answer is for all of but about 77 years of Israel's history. Mm-hmm. 70 under Daud, about 7 under Hezekiah.
Yeah, well, they're always...
Israel, as a nation, has been Goyim.
Yeah.
The antithesis of Israel, estranged from Israel, following the ways of the Gentiles. Right?
Didn't you open the show with that?
Yeah. So, that is why I think it says to Goyim. Now, if you got a different reason, you know, by all means, share it. Or in your womb.
Right. Yeah.
No, and two transformational population groups who will gather together as part of distinct political and religious entities, Laom. People of different nations who will congregate together under their own unique leaders who are archaic and thus changed by an antiquated philosophy. From within your viscera, who will disperse and be separate. Now, we're just getting started here, but Laom. What he's saying here now is there's going to be two very distinct groups of people here. I don't think you could find a more transformational population group or distinct political or religious entities than Israel, particularly Israel as they became religious and rabbinical. And Rome. In fact, if you look at Rome, there was only one group of people that Rome would not assimilate. Only one group of people that Rome said, we despise them so much, we don't want them practicing our religion, and we don't want to allow them to practice theirs. There's only one place that Rome sent multiple legions multiple times, which was not someone they wanted to conquer, but someone they already were subjugating. With the intent of wiping them off the planet. The single most celebrated structure in all of Rome, the Colosseum, was funded in its entirety and built in its entirety based upon the first conquest of Jerusalem. Jerusalem. It's the money that was taken by looting the temple and the slaves that were brought back to Rome to build it. Two transformational population groups will gather as part of distinct political and religious entities. Both changed by an antiquated philosophy. Both influenced by their own unique leaders. On Israel, you know, the Maccabees gave way to the rabbinic types, you know, that fight between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And the rabbis ultimately won. And then you have Akiva as the father of rabbinic Judaism. That's the leader. And then you've got in Rome, Julius Caesar, and then Augustus, and the Caesars that would follow, and you know, the
right up to Hadrian
religion that they promoted is very distinct from the Jewish religion. Very distinct people, very distinct outlook. One was the most aggressive and militaristic on the planet. The other couldn't even protect itself.
No.
The other one, it knew nothing of expansion. And the other thrived on expansion. They're as different as two could possibly be. And they were vicious towards one another. And even in the evolution of Imperial Rome to Roman Catholicism, all the way to Pope Pius the XII, without whom there would have been no Hitler. No Hitler rising to power. He would never have been able to solidify his power in Germany. It required the obliteration of the Catholic Democratic Party. It required the endorsement of the Roman Catholic Church for him to do that. And then it required the Roman Catholic Church, which was the most influential institution in Europe, being not only completely silent, but actually siding with the purposes of the Holocaust, all of which Pope Pius did. Roman Catholic Church, we're talking about as bad could be. So Yahweh said concerning her, two estranged political and religious entities, Goyim, are in your womb, and two transformational populations group who will gather as part of distinct political and religious entities from your viscera, who will disperse and separate. Who will be divided and separated. Boy, I tell you what, there was no one who divided. In fact, the diaspora is Roman-based. Becoming completely different and distinct. They will deal harshly with one another, spreading out and severing the relationship. And one distinct group of people, differentiated and changed by their choice of political and religious leader, Laom Men Laom, shall be stronger, more militaristic, and more acclaimed, albeit more obstinate and self-willed. Gee. Do we ever talk about the grandeur that was Yehuda? Do we ever talk about the military legions of Israel? Do we ever talk about the pox?
Pox in Israel. No.
How about the empire of the Jews?
No, they stay between the river.
But Rome defines political strength, militaristic strength, more militaristic, more acclaimed. There is no nation in the history of the world that's more acclaimed than Rome, nor any that was more militaristic until the United States, nor any more obstinate or self-willed. One will achieve a higher status through force and conquest while being especially stubborn, incapable of changing beliefs. And the many, the more numerous and greater, the Rab, shall work for and serve the lowly and little. amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know who the lowly and little is. It's the R in this, the younger, smaller, and insignificant who diminishes. Yeah, they became Roman Catholicism, and they would work for and serve Shaul, Paul, the lowly and little. So this prophetic statement does not read as the Christian Bible's translation suggests, with the older son being ruled over by the younger. Christian theologians have misrepresented the Hebrew text, largely because of Paul's pro-government argument in his letter penned on behalf of the Romans, and because they see their church as the second born, subjugating Jews, the first of the covenant, and thereby inheriting the promises made to Israel. In actuality, this is a comparison between Jacob, Jacob, and Esau, Esau, between Israel and the Roman and Islamic world. Jacob was focused on being right and was thus innocent before Yahweh because he prioritized family, staying at home, camping out with God. Esau preferred weapons and killing, and he was always on the move because he roamed the world as a hunter.
Have you ever met a hunter? People that really, really hunt, not occasionally go out and get something. But people that really, really hunt, that don't enjoy the kill. I mean, it's just a...
They love the kill. I mean, the guy that I knew back in Virginia that was the most avid hunter, fat, obese guy. A nice guy, but really, really heavy set. And chewing tobacco was his thing. And he had guns like you cannot believe. And he would want to come into our farm to hunt the deer because we had all these comfy roads, 5 miles of roads, and he could drive around at night and spotlight them and shoot them from his car. And he would tell me that, invite me on these hunting trips. I would never go. And he would go on hunting trips like the prairie dogs.
Mm-hmm.
He would go out and shoot and kill 150 prairie dogs a day just for fun, just because they poked up their head and he could blow their heads off.
Killing for fun.
Yeah. I look at the majority of those that go into the Army and the Marines. They're guys that like to hunt and kill.
My two nephews were brought up hunting, and they both joined the Army.
Yeah.
Both served. Yeah. And one came back in bad shape, and the other one is still in. So it's just all from that.
Now, God wasn't finished here. He said, and the first, Rishon, the head, chief, foremost, and beginning, came out ruddy and bloody red. Adonai, his entire nature, similar to a hairy, glorified robe of magnificent splendor. You know the word for hairy? You know the hairy? The word for hairy is in Hebrew?
Fior?
Mm-hmm. What's the word for hairy in Latin?
Fior.
What are the Romans most known for?
They're king. They are emperors. I mean, they're
Caesars, right?
Yeah, Caesars.
Mm-hmm. In fact, prior to the Caesars, Rome didn't give two hoots about Israel, did they?
Never.
Prior to the Caesars, not even a mention of Israel.
No.
But come the Caesars, particularly under Augustus, Israel becomes a toy. Yeah. And then thereafter, Israel was the source of hatred and violence. It's the Caesars who paraded around as if they were gods, who didn't like the Jews because the Jews wouldn't worship a man as God.
Mm-hmm.
And they turned on him.
Yeah.
It all pivots on this one word. The leaders of Imperial Rome were all called Caesars. And that is what God is saying, that he was bloody red, and his entire nature was similar to Caesar. Now, if that doesn't like say, wait a minute, we're talking about not only the term most identifiable with Rome, Caesar's, but it was under the Caesars that every detail of this prophecy became true.
Yes.
Just the entire nature would be similar to. Not just an aspect of it. His entire nature would be reflected in the concept of Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think God gave two hoots that the boy was furry? Do you think God is so lame that he's going to describe somebody by their ethnicity, their skin color, by a blemish on their skin?
That's interesting.
Or is the fact that his entire nature was defined by the fact he was Caesar designed to tell us something?
Mm-hmm.
And that he wore glorified, it was like the Caesar with a glorified robe of magnificent splendor.
Mm-hmm.
Rome.
Yeah.
The mantle of cloak of hair, which was considered grand and glorious. The famous and glorified kings, nobles, and chieftains who lord over great and majestic nations is what is an Adareth. Did Esau himself wear these splendorous robes? Did he rule over great nations?
No, but he was considered hairy. That was the little story, you know.
Right. The word is based on Adash, which means to tread upon and trample down. What is the thing that God said was going to be the trait that he despised so much in the worst and final beast, the Roman Catholic Church? It would what the world?
It would trample over the world.
Tread and trample down the entire world. And that is what the basis of this word means.
Would you, here's a little sad tidbit here. The head of Germany was always called Kaiser, which is a root from that as well. And the Tsar of Russia, of course, is the Tsar.
Yeah, both based on the same
thing. And look,
the Hebrew word
is connecting with Jerusalem. There, they hate
based
it.
On exactly the same Hebrew word that became the Latin word.
Right.
Caesar. And keep in mind, Caesar does not mean king. It doesn't mean emperor. Doesn't mean pharaoh. Caesar means hairy. Just as it does in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm. What a connection.
Now, this is interesting. So they called his name, what do they call his name? Caesar? No. They call his name Adareth, glorified robes and magnificent splendor? No. You know, with Yaakov it says, you know, he grabbed hold of the heel and put his hand on the heel. Well, Yod is hand and a cube is heel. His name is hand on heel. Esau, is his name a blend of Caesar and Adareth? No, Esau is based on the Hebrew word that means one who engages and acts this way.
No.
It's based on the Shah. So he's saying, I'm naming this kid the one who acts and engages in such things as the Caesars, as those who wear the magnificent robes of splendor.
Can't argue with this stuff.
Go ahead. You want to try to trivialize this? Go ahead. But I don't know how God could have been any more direct in telling us, I named him this way because he acts this way. He acts like the Caesars. He came out bloody red. He wears magnificent robes and magnificent splendor and is considered grand and glorious like the chieftains over great nations, comprised of the sea, Gentiles, who tramples down a legacy of Imperial Rome as the Roman Catholic Church, trampling down the whole world. So God named him one who acts this way, who engages in such things. After this, then, his brother came forth, and his hand was grasped firmly upon Esau's heel. And so his name was called Jacob, hand and heel, from Yod, hand, and Jacob, heel.
Yeah.
Meaning, where one stands and walks based upon what one reaches for and does with one's hands and feet. When the boys grew great, Esau, the one who acts this way and engages in such things, became an individual who knew hunting, the act of pursuing, capturing, and killing. Ta'ad. Hunting is a game, often through snares and trapping. As an individual spreading out within the open and broad way, a synonym for religion.
Mm-hmm.
And Jacob's hand and heel was correct and innocent, Tom blameless. An individual who established a dwelling place, intense, a well. One stayed put in Yisrael. One established a home in God's home. He lived in a well, focused on his family.
Yeah.
So not only was Imperial Rome the bloodiest Adonai beast, red Adonai in tooth and claw, all of the foremost leaders, Rishon, of the nation most at war with Israel were Caesars, say R. Naming themselves after Julius the Hairy, C-R in Latin. They were, say R, horrible and tempestuous, fearsome and dreaded, bristling and formidable. From the human perspective of Laom nations, they were Adareth, cloaked in glory and magnificent. Such they are, we are all predisposed to juxtapose splendor in Rome. Moreover, this Adareth was composed of the sea and thus comprised of Gentiles, and its legacy, that of the final and fifth beast, the Roman Catholic Church, was foretold to Adash, tread upon and trample down the whole world. If that were not enough to associate Esau with Rome, consider why the man Yahweh grew to hate, that's in Malachi, Malachi 1:3, wasn't named using a contraction of Adonai or Zayar, as was the case with Yaakov being derived from a mix of Yod and Akab, but was instead depicted as someone who was Anash, engaged in such things. Further affirming this appraisal in this pronouncement, Esau is being identified with Nimrod, the first child of Babylon, the beast which evolved into Rome and Roman Catholicism. Esau, the one who acts this way and engages in such things, pursued hunting, capturing and killing. While doing so, he spread out in the open and broad way. No nation has ever been as deadly as Rome, a nation which made pursuing and capturing and killing men its national pastime. And the Roman religion, the amalgamation of Babel and Bible, came to epitomize the deadly and popular nature of the broad and open way. And I'm sure that all of our listeners know that Nimrod was the mighty hunter against God.
Yes, against the helm.
Now, unless you've got something you want to add to that, we can move on to Yirmiyah 51:58, because that's the next presentation of Laom, and it takes us to a most interesting place.
No, far away.
You know, I wanted to finish this volume. Let me say this, and then I want to hear what you have to say, Kirk. I wanted to finish, and I made a commitment when I started Observations in Our Time. I said the last thing I want to do is I want to tie Christianity and religion and Hasatan and Babel all together, because I think God uses them indistinguishably. Well,
that
guess what was brought into this text? Babel. And it happens to be the precursor of the text that Yosha quoted when he said Babylon has fallen in Revelation. Now, go ahead, Kirk.
No, I was just saying this stuff is so riveting, and I've already read it. I've actually tried to translate some of it and all as well, and looked up the key words and all. But I don't care who you are, if you're reading this with any type of logical brain, I mean, and with what you have at your disposal to check, I mean, this is not a wild translation. This is just so straightforward. I mean,
this was the easiest one that I've done in a long time, and I was so surprised that I had missed it all this time. I never understood it before, because the way the English Bible is translated, it never happened.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, Israel didn't rule over anybody.
No.
And so, and the words don't say that. So it was one of the easier ones to do, but it was one of those where, for me, it was profound. I got goosebumps. It was really profound for me to do this one. And as was the Yirmiyah 51. And now I'm going to tell you that you know, I've written an entire chapter after this. I've sent it to you, Kirk. The final chapter of volume 2.
Yes. Don't change anything number 1.
I've written that whole other chapter. And now I'm writing the first chapter of volume 3. And I was so amazed with this Yirmiyah prophecy and how it ends with Babylon finally falling in the last days. I'm actually beginning the next volume at Yirmiyah 48 with the fall of Moab. And the reason I did that is because if you remember 3 chapters ago, or 1 chapter before Yahshua 17, the whole chapter is on Moab and what Moab represents, which is this artificial amalgamation of Pauline Christianity and political correctness, social secular humanism, multiculturalism, are all the latter day incarnation of Moab. And so I begin it with the fall of Moab and why God wipes out Moab, which this is the modern incarnation of Moab in the last days. And I don't know how many chapters it's going to take me to get from 48 to 51 because Yirmiyah is not shy on words. You know, every statement in Yirmiyah is 20 or 30 words long. So
you met your match.
I've met my match, and I've just got now through the first statement in Yirmiyah that I wanted to translate. And I said, okay, now do I go on here, or do I break this down and share the insights that I've derived so far just from that one statement? And I'm on, it took 4 pages just to cover Yirmiyah 48:38.
Wow.
4 pages. Every word is just tantalizing in it. So, you know, that's where we're going. Anyway, so this is this is Yirmiyah 51:58. So we'll return, and we're going to go way back to 48 as we begin this in 2 chapters hence. But it reads, after a great passage of time, we are humiliated and ashamed, despairing, for finally having to come to realize that we have been wrong. Bosh, at long last, we are confounded and confused. Now that the appropriate amount of time has passed, we recognize that we are shameful and disgraced, even disappointed and disconcerted. For we have not come to hear, we have come to hear, Shama, contemptible defiance and vile insults and scorn, being taunted by shameful slurs, Remember, it was here that they, when the Yahu, the slur of Yahweh's name, being openly and publicly ashamed, along with the confusing insults, have come to clothe us in our presence, just as we have kept vital information from others to establish our authority. Because foreigners, those deemed illegitimate or unauthorized, have derived upon the set-apart place of the home of Yahweh, which, of course, they would have written as Hashem or the Lord. Now, there have been, half a dozen times in human history where this has occurred. The Assyrians did this, but Yahweh through Hezekiah took care of it. Now, the Assyrians are mostly focused on Israel and the northern kingdom. They weren't very successful with, and there was certainly, there was a brief moment where that Jews were realized they had been wrong, that you don't really get that sense of the story in the Hezekiah story. You really get the sense of one guy figured it out, and because he had the ability to act on behalf of the nation, straighten the nation out, and the nation wasn't ashamed, the nation was celebratory.
Yes.
So this is not the Hezekiah story when the Assyrians were surrounding Jerusalem. Now the Babylonians came and they hauled everybody off to Babylon. But you don't get a sense that the Yehudah, when they were being hauled off to Babylon, said, "Woe is us! We're ashamed. We did bad. We haven't listened to God." You don't get that sense, do you?
No.
No. And then when the Romans came twice, rather than turning to God and saying, "You know, Yahweh, we need to listen to you," no, they did exactly the opposite. They turned from him.
Mm-hmm. Fair choice.
And so, I mean, those are the times when the set apart spot of the place of Yahweh was overrun by foreigners. That was overrun by foreigners again with Muslims and crusaders. But when that happened, there weren't enough Jews there to count on two hands.
True.
So this is a last day statement. Because after a great passage of time, we're finally humiliated and ashamed. We're despairing for having come to realize that we have been wrong. And that's what they're going to have to do. They're going to read the neck. They're going to turn to the Torah. They're going to listen to Dode. They're going to recognize they've been wrong. And they've come to hear contemptible defiance, vile insults, and scorn. As much as Yehudim and Israelites have been mocked and taunted with shameful slurs, and no one has ever accumulated more of them throughout time than Jews,
correct.
It's going to get so bad.
What is going to be?
It's going to make it's going to make the lead up to the Holocaust look like it was, kids playing on Halloween, trick or treat.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah. It's going to get so bad that Yahweh is going to remove all of his family because he doesn't want his family even to hear it. You know, there's a reason why Yahweh picked two guys who, were pulled out of the world thousands of years ago to be the two witnesses during those days. He was not going to leave the world without a witness, but it isn't going to be us. It's not going to be mortal men.
No.
Enoch and Elia have been tasked with this job, but they're coming back as spiritual beings.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to get really nasty. And then it says, being openly and publicly shamed, along with confusing insults. That's what's come to clothe our presence, just as we have kept vital information from others to establish our authority. What would you say is the single most important bit of information the Jews have kept to themselves in order to establish their religious authority?
Well, they wiped out his name, for one thing.
That would be it.
Yeah.
No second.
That sees everything else once you understand his name. I mean,
oh, yeah, there's no Islam. But if Yahweh's name had remained intact, there was no Islam. If Yahweh's name had remained intact, there's no Christianity.
Paul got run out of Jerusalem because he couldn't compete with people who were not rabbis.
Right.
They were
right.
Followers of the way, right. And they knew more than they had
correct.
More trouble
right.
fighting him, arguing with him.
Now, there's something else that was vital information that Jews kept obscured. They've hidden, they concealed its true nature. The Torah.
Well, I would think the Mitzvah, the Torah, yeah. The Torah. The
yeah, the Torah. Yeah, the Torah.
Find your way home.
They concealed its true nature. They called it a set of laws, and then they wrote a bunch of edicts as arguments.
Which should do. Yeah.
Called the Talmud. Right. Replaced it with their oral law.
Oral Torah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because foreigners, those deemed illegitimate, who are unauthorized, have arrived upon the set-apart place of the home of Yahweh. They wouldn't even have recognized his name as Yahweh back in the day that these other attacks were occurring.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't. To say Yahweh's name during the time of the Roman attacks was to be put to death.
Yeah.
Capital offense.
This
is the time of the Islamic attack.
Yeah.
That's why you find it in one of the last chapters of Yirmiyah. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, prophetically declares Yahweh, when I will account for her religious images and objects of worship. And throughout all of her land, the defiled and reprehensible shall groan in anguish. Has there been any time in other than Hezekiah, which was voluntary, it was Hezekiah accounting for them,
mm-hmm.
when Yahweh intervened to do away with the religious objects in Israel?
This one's coming up.
Yeah, there's one coming up. Mm-hmm. But if you look in the past, there isn't one in the past.
No.
So Yahweh doesn't intervene very often, free will and all. But, you know, in the last days, I've been translating a passage, that one in Yirmiyah 48, where it says free will is no more.
Yeah, that's
when Yahweh wipes out Moab, which is calling Christianity and social secular humanism, there is no more free will.
Yeah, they're trapped.
So, this is something he's talking about in the future, and in his animosity, what Yahweh is going to do, he's going to account for, he's going to choose to execute judgment on, and ascribe a proper penalty after an accurate assessment on her religious images and objects of worship, the representations of her gods, including her carved and cast in holy and sanctified and hallowed and blessed divine depictions. All the things that people think are holy and honorable and religious. God says, that's what I'm going to judge. And he calls them defiled and reprehensible. Isn't that something?
Well, I mean, it should come as a shock. Every time he talks about idols, he does the same thing. He just cannot stand them. He can't stand people. Don't make them. Don't bow down to them. Don't represent them. I mean, and then all through the streets of every town, they're all over the place. You go home and you see them crosses everywhere in everybody's houses now. I'm just like, my God, people.
You find crosses being worn by people who aren't Christians.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a Israeli that came in to clean the carpets of my home here in Florida. Mm-hmm. And we had this amazing discussion. And he's now an atheist, as are a lot of Israelites. And yeah, he never even calls himself an Israeli. And he was an atheist. And I said, you're probably an atheist because you've rejected Judaism. Is that correct? He said, well, yeah, I've rejected Judaism. I think that when I was in religious school in Israel, I thought that Judaism was just absolutely crazy. So, yeah, I rejected Judaism. I said, so you're holding the religion of Judaism against God, so you're an atheist because the religion of Judaism is stupid. He said, well, it's not the only stupid religion, so is Christianity and so is Islam. I said, so what if I were to tell you that God hates religion? And he was just like, huh? I said, you know, God has a name. And you know, we went through the Hebrew alphabet and how it had been corrupted and what it means. And it was really interesting to have a conversation with an Israeli about their vocabulary, their language, their revelation from God, and how screwed up they were. Be interesting to see what happens with this fellow. And of course, you know, I walk down the street, and almost everyone is homosexual. And most everybody's got to think that I must be too, since everybody in the neighborhood is. And everybody's Jewish. I mean, I've got to have a higher concentration of Jews on my street than live in Israel. It's the darnest thing. And who would have thought that of all people, the people most prone to become homosexual would be Jews?
I wouldn't have thought that, no.
No, but you know where the city in the world is that where homosexuality is the most overt and the most celebrated? Where homosexuals will say is their go-to place, but they're kind of a mecca for homosexuality?
West LA?
Tel Aviv.
Really?
Tel Aviv.
I didn't know that.
And it's the most openly homosexual city in the world.
Wow.
Most popular city in Israel.
Wow.
And so here I'm surrounded. And by the way, they're the nicest guys, all of them. They really are. They're the nicest guys. But it kind of goes down to this whole thing of, if someone chooses to be homosexual, on a 1 to 10 scale of things that bother me, it's not even a 1.
Yeah.
I mean, would I be, like, creeped out to the max? I've seen two guys go at it together. Yeah, I didn't really. If my skin would crawl, I'd be really creeped out. But, you know, the things that bother me are militarism and religion and political lies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the stuff that I think is worth our angst. You know, the likelihood that you're going to convince somebody that God exists and he's knowable, you got a much better chance with an agnostic homosexual than you do with a religious heterosexual. Or a heterosexual person who's into politics or patriotism or militarism.
Well, when they get into politics and military religion, then they're hooked. Then it's a whole nother animal.
You know, something that, I mean, you know that I have no regard for Trump. But he said something today that I don't know if he'll ever act upon it, but he tweeted it out. It's time to recognize that the Golan Heights is part of Israel.
Yeah.
The world, of course, has a connection to it. But it's true. You know, why would the world have a conniption fit other than they hate Israel, when the fact that the only reason that Israel controls it now is because the launched a surprise attack and lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to attack your neighbor and try to wipe them out and you lose, there's a consequence for losing.
Right? Yeah. Absolutely. And rightfully so.
Right, rightfully so. Of course, the UN voted today to admonish and sanction Israel for killing the civilians as part of the quote-unquote Palestinian Hamas uprisings in Gaza, where these civilians were flying kites with Molotov cocktails in them so they could set Israel on fire. And, of course, they were storming the fence because they wanted to die as martyrs. And one of the nations that abstained from the vote was England. And the English ambassador said, you know, we recognize Israel's right to defend itself. But they ought to do so with rubber bullets and not live ammunition. Well, if you're shooting rubber bullets, do you think you're going to dissuade the people that are trying to burn your country down?
Hardly. No.
And by the way, do you think that the Royal Marines and the Royal Air Force and the UK are firing rubber bullets from their guns?
No.
You know, when the Germans decided they wanted to invade England, did Winston Churchill say, "Let's arm those son of a guns with rubber bullets"?
Now, sometimes we sound so stupid. I can't stand it.
And of course, the world was saying that the reason what Israel did was so egregious is because they were killing civilians, and that's never.
That's not allowed.
Is there a Hamas army? Of course not.
There's a Hamas.
They're all civilians.
Yeah.
They're all civilians.
The entire group.
The entire group. The terrorists are all civilians. The Islamic State was all civilians. Al-Qaeda, all civilians. The PLO, all civilians. Of course they kill civilians. It's the civilians who are the terrorists. The nature of Islam. This is Israeli, by the way. One to argue with me on Islam. And he said that when he was four, his neighbor told him the truth about the jihad, and the jihad is a spiritual struggle.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, and you believed him?
Yeah.
Rather than recognizing that 99.9% of all terrorist acts are perpetrated by Muslims, you instead believed your 4-year-old neighbor. I said, well, what reason would he have to lie to me? So, if you lived in Nazi Germany, and a German did a really nice job of tending to the flowers in their front lawn and spoke nicely to their children, would you assume that Nazism was a loving and compassionate dogma?
And he said,
if your neighbor told you that we are really loving, how would you read the text of Mein Kampf and look at the actions of the consequence of the religion? Oh, wow. It's amazing how people can be so stupid.
Well, you heard about Mississippi, right, this week?
What happened in Mississippi?
They had 37 clergy. They admitted 37 of their clergy from, it goes all the way back to 1930 up until 1990-something, 1,400 victims, pedophilia and so forth. And they said, you know, we're really sorry.
The Roman Catholic Church?
Yeah.
1,400 victims.
1,400 victims in Mississippi. Over
37
different clergy, and they hit them, and everything is like normal, just like a normal thing. They're everywhere. And why is there a Catholic church left standing in Mississippi?
Yeah, why is there a single Roman Catholic left in the world?
Yeah. What do you need?
Because people are just name popes. That's why when Yahweh says, you know, I'm eliminating free will, and it's just over, you're either with me or against me. If you're against me, it's over for you. When I annihilate you, you're gone. Out of here. Good riddance.
Yeah.
I have no pity for them.
No. Don't warn them.
No. They have been warned. They're just unwilling to even think. Shame on them.
Yeah.
Too bad. It's a shame, but the vast preponderance of the people are not. Not only won't they take the time to figure out the basics of their religion are not only untrue, but could not even in the wildest imagination be true, to actually do what we did here today.
Mm-hmm.
To take these words and scrutinize them and carefully consider Yahweh's testimony. I have no interest in it.
But this is like
that would be smart just for doing so.
Oh. I'm not eloquent in speech, but the greatest thing that's happened, you know, is that when I read your book, you taught us how to do this, and we've practiced over time, and you've always been accessible, so I could ask you things, you know, via email or and eventually by talking with you like this, and cluing me in on what this, and then JB has great knowledge of this as well, so I could bug him and say, well, how do you do this, and what do you use, and so forth. But once you get that, I feel so prepared that I can't be tricked anymore.
Right.
You know, I know exactly what it says. I can dig it out, and I'm always excited because it's such a big volume of work that y'all would talk about. So you're not going to run out of stuff in our lifetime before much less later.
Right.
Knowing him, but why wouldn't you take the time?
You can not only find the answers, you find the affirmations.
Absolutely.
You find the clues, you find the insights, you find the fun. It's just all there.
Yeah. And you go back later and you find some more. It's amazing when you thought you got it.
Oh, yeah.
You said that too, you know.
Oh, yeah. You look at those two chapters that I wrote 7 years ago. And they were both, one was like 25 pages, the other like 40 pages. And between the two of them now, they're about 250 pages.
Yeah.
And maybe they'd be a lot more, except I decided, well, you know, I think I better start a new chapter.
You have a limit at any given time.
Yeah. When my favorite editors read it and say, you know, there's some really good stuff here, but I think you need to cut it back. Because it's a bit overwhelming.
I read the email, yeah.
Yes. You know, it's just like this chapter. I wanted to really make my way through with significant haste to that passage that both uses Laom and Babel in the same passage because I thought it would be so insightful. Oh, and it also uses neck.
Yeah, that's
and so I had a passage here that's Laom, but particularly neck and Babel, and one used to refute the other. And so what a wonderful place for us to begin a new volume. It's in the 56th chapter, so I started just reading statement by statement back from 58, just one back. Well, I won myself back until I was at the midpoint in chapter 48. I said, you know, if I read any further, I'm going to be back to the front. Hopefully, it stands up. Here we go. So, let me start here.
Yeah.
It's a lifetime of learning.
You ain't kidding. But it's fun. It's really fun. You're back a way out, but it's fun.
Yeah, that's true. I just got a new chair, so I'm good to go here for a while. A new monitor about a couple of months ago. I got a really, really nice, big, curved monitor. So I got a really big monitor now. I got a new keyboard because I wore my out. I used my keyboard to the point that I wore the letters off of them. So it was literally, it wasn't on Pac-Man. There were no more letters. The letters are all over off the keys. You know you've written a lot when you've when you're pouring the letters off your keyboard.
Well,
so I'm all set up now. I got a desk with a view, a big curved monitor, a really comfy chair for my back, and the keyboard and mouse.
Life's good.
Life's good. Yep. And I'm back to working at it 5 or 6 hours a day.
Oh, good for you, man.
Yeah, so it's back to being a lot of fun. It's been really a lot of insight, so it's been particularly insightful.
Well, this has been wonderful reading and studying it. I haven't gotten to 18, the final review on 18. The 17 was very good. I like the point that you added the stuff about the article that you sent me on the Pope Pius.
Oh, my. Isn't that something?
Yeah,
somewhere I've got to incorporate some of Pope Pius's. Yeah, that was sent to me, too, because I made the statement that I thought that Roman Catholicism was tangential to the rise of Hitler and Nazi power, and that their biggest crime was omission, just not doing anything.
Hardly.
And maybe helping some of the Nazis escape in the end, and that is the furthest from the truth.
Yeah, that's
Pius the 12th, prior to the time that he became Pope, is going to that man is easily going to be in the top 10 most hated people by Yahweh. He was disgustingly anti-Semitic, and he was insatiable in his thirst for dictatorial power for the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
And his the most important treaty was also the one that Hitler spent the most time on. Hitler spent vastly more time on this agreement with the Roman Catholic Church than anything else that solidified his power. And it gave him the justification for the Holocaust.
Yeah.
It's all.
Yeah, really,
all was served up to him
awful.
By the Roman Catholic Church. Yeah, so you read that article?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We both did. Terry and I both did.
Yeah, that was an article that it took me 6 or 7, maybe 8 days to read.
Mm-hmm.
That's because I would read a page of it,
mm-hmm.
and then I got so sick by what I was reading, I'd have to go away and go to something else. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hear you. That's pretty awful stuff. Pretty awful.
Now, I do have some bad news. I do have to hang up and leave because my little Asher, my cute little yellow lab, is just as cute as she can be. She just decided that she would freshen the air here in my study. I can't breathe. My eyes are watering. I don't know what she ate today, but it wasn't good.
Shalom.
Before I die of asphyxiation, my friend.
Yeah, we don't want to die in it. Asher, give him a break.
All right. Well, it was wonderful being with you this evening. Shalom.
Pleasure.
Yeah,
shalom.
Happy Shabbat. Bye.
Happy Shabbat to you, too.